This is Todd Capone, author of The Transparency Sale: How Unexpected Honesty and Understanding the Buying Brain Can Transform Your Results. And you are listening to the Marketing Book Podcast.
Welcome to the Marketing Book Podcast, helping you keep up with the smartest thinking in the quickly changing field of modern marketing. And now, here's your host, Douglas Burdett.
Hello, thanks for joining me on the Marketing Book Podcast, where each week I publish an interview with the author of a new marketing or sales book, and which was named by LinkedIn as one of 10 podcasts that will make you a better marketer. My goal for this podcast is to help you discover new ideas in order to succeed in the quickly changing field of modern marketing and sales. Don't worry about taking notes. You can find links to everything linkable in this episode's show notes at marketingbookpodcast.com. And since you're a listener to the Marketing Book Podcast, if I can recommend a specific marketing or sales book or some other helpful resource that I know of for whatever situation you find yourself in, feel free to connect with me on LinkedIn where we can chat, and I'll try to point you in the right direction. This show is produced by my marketing firm. We work with manufacturers to help them grow. If you're a manufacturer and are serious about growing your business, check out our guide to lead generation for manufacturers on our website, salesartillery.com, or Google lead generation for manufacturers, and you'll find the guide at the top of the organic results. And special thanks to this episode's sponsor, Blinkist. Blinkist is a really cool app that takes the key insights from the best nonfiction books and distills them into a format that you can read or listen to in just 15 minutes on your smartphone. Several of the books featured on the Marketing Book Podcast are on Blinkist. Right now, Blinkist has a special offer for Marketing Book Podcast listeners where you can sign up for free at Blinkist.com/marketingbookpodcast. Blinkist is spelled B-L-I-N-K-I-S-T. And if you opt for the paid version, you'll get an additional 20% off, but only if you go to Blinkist.com/marketingbookpodcast or just click on the link at marketingbookpodcast.com. And now, on with the show. Today, we welcome Todd Capone to the Marketing Book Podcast to talk about his book, The Transparency Sale: How Unexpected Honesty and Understanding the Buying Brain Can Transform Your Results, published by Idea Press. Todd is a keynote speaker, workshop leader, and trainer, is principal and founder of Sales Melon. And up until last year, he spent almost 4 years building the revenue capacity of Chicago's Power Reviews from the ground up as their chief revenue officer, turning it into Illinois' fastest growing tech company. Prior to that, he held leadership roles with three other tech companies, including ExactTarget, where he helped drive the organization to a successful IPO and a $2.7 billion exit through the acquisition of Salesforce.com. And interesting fact, Todd can ride a unicycle and juggle. Todd, congratulations on the transparency sale, and welcome to the Marketing Book Podcast.
Thank you so much for having me. Can't wait.
So this has the coolest book cover out of the first 225 books on the podcast. The book is called The Transparency Sale. So what you do is you had the book, the hardcover, and it's got the subtitle on it, and then you've got a transparent book jacket. I see what you did there, Mr. Capone.
Yeah, the concept was that if the book was no good, at least it would look great on your shelf.
Well, it is a good book, and I enjoyed it. So for what that's worth. Now, there's always a first-time listener to the Marketing Book Podcast, and this may be their first time listening, and they're thinking, wait a minute, I thought I was listening to the Marketing Book Podcast. Why do we have a book about sales? Now, here's why. The most successful marketers these days have a deep understanding of sales, the sales process, or more importantly, the buying process. They've been on a lot of sales calls. They might even come up through sales. It's a requirement now, and that's why. And also, it gives you a better insight into the world of your sales counterparts, but you also, or at least I do, I get so many ideas for great content that you could be producing to help make the sale easier and help your sales counterparts. Todd, before we started recording, you were talking a bit about that. Talk a bit about how you stopped reading sales books, I guess, before you started writing this book.
Yeah, I've always been a I guess, self-proclaimed nerd for sales philosophy and methodology and process. And as I started to realize that there was an evolution happening in the world of sales, the way to really vet that out was to try not to allow myself to be biased by other people's opinions on what sales is or should be. And so I started down the path of reading a lot about neuroscience. I mean, the neuroscience community has learned more about how we as human beings make decisions in the last 10 years than probably 1,000 years before that. And then a lot around what I call, I guess it's called neuromarketing, but it's, you know, how to use and leverage the way that consumers make decisions to maximize marketing efforts. And a lot of that was fodder for the concepts and fully developing them for the book.
Terrific. And I guess it's those MRI machines that are enabling so much of this so many new discoveries about the brain, how the brain works. And it is, I've had a few other books on the show, and they're just fascinating, talking about what they're learning about how the brain works, particularly as it relates to buying decisions.
Yeah, and many of it is so counter to what we assume. If you'll allow me for a second here, there's a book by Martin Lindstrom, I believe it's called Biology.
Yes.
Where he brings in the book, he talks about a study he did where he brought 2,080 smokers into a lab. So they're people that are, you know, addicted to smoking, showed them a cigarette warning label on their way in. And in every case, people used their logic and said, yeah, those things are really disturbing to me. I really need to stop. And then when he took them and put them into an fMRI machine, he found that their craving centers in their brains actually lit up when they saw the cigarette warning labels. And in essence, the cigarette warning labels were doing the opposite of what they were intended to do. They were actually telling the smoking brain that, hey, you know what? Cigarette would be really nice right now. And it's just things like that that I just couldn't stop. I spent so much time in my local library and learned a ton through this process. It was, you know, that I'm so proud of the book, but I'm almost as proud of everything that I learned in the last year. It's probably the greatest learning experience in my career.
Oh, I can imagine. So I should state for the listeners, you have a marketing degree from Indiana University. And I just want to say that before I read this one excerpt from the book. I have spent nearly all my career working in sales, and everything I learned was about the importance of the relationship. There are countless books on how to close deals, build your network, be a trusted advisor, and nurture relationships. So I couldn't help thinking, surely sales, which has always been highly dependent on personal relationships, could never be reduced to mere reviews. This question drove me to spend the next year exploring the shifting evolution of how to sell effectively in a world filled with on-demand reviews. It led me to uncover one startling truth that drove me to write this book. To understand this truth, we should start with a quick review of some interesting research into how consumers research and buy the things they need online today. According to the research, 95% of consumers use reviews for their online purchases, with 86% considering them to be an important part of their purchase journey. 82% of consumers specifically seek out negative reviews when making a purchase. Purchase likelihood peaks when the average star rating of a product is between 4.2 and 4.5 stars on a 5-star scale. So let's consider that again. A product with a 4.2 star rating sells better than one with a perfect 5.0. Inherently, this makes sense. Our brains are wired to resist being sold to, and so this is an understandable defense mechanism. It also leads to the single truth at the heart of this book. Todd Capone, what is the single truth at the heart of your book?
Well, it is clearly that transparency sells better than perfection. And I'll tell you, when you just consider that idea, when the book came out and I've had so many people tell me, you know, Todd, I so agree with the concepts. I've always embraced authenticity and honesty. But so many of these people seem to think that it's at a cost, that by being authentic and honest, I'm actually reducing my results. And the data combined with the science actually say the opposite, that when you embrace transparency and you lead with your flaws and know that nobody sells anything that is perfect, it actually maximizes your results.
Amazing. So just one more quote. It's a very quotable book there, Mr. Capone.
Well, thank you.
The transparency sale is about giving people all of the information the brain requires to feel confident about making a decision. It's about framing our solutions as 4.2 to 4.5 and no longer positioning as though we're a perfect 5.0. It's about understanding how feelings and emotions influence the decisions buyers make. It's about how your potential prospects and buyers make the majority of their decisions subconsciously. Understanding that the selling cycle isn't just about getting your buyers to make one decision to buy from you. The selling cycle requires a recognition that the buyer is making hundreds or even thousands of subconscious micro decisions. Now, what I want to ask though is, how does being transparent actually shorten a sales cycle?
Well, I tell you, the impetus behind this is not only that data, but just waking up one morning and sitting on the couch with my daughter. And as she was looking to download an iPad app, and as we were trying to decide what show or movie to watch on Netflix, she was 6 years old. She couldn't really read, but she was selecting based on the reviews. Not the reviews themselves, but the star ratings. And I started thinking about this
She was six?
Yes, 6 years old, and she was looking for a Princess game. And in one, it had to be 10 seconds. She picked the game, and she wanted me to select a movie. And then she looked at the star rating on that and said, I want this game and that movie. Mm-hmm. And I asked her, and she said, oh, the star ratings. Like, this one's a little less than 5 stars, and these other princess games are 1 star. I'm not going to pick those. And when you think about the way that reviews and feedback are now so pervasive in everything we do, from not only the products we buy. So, I mean, picking an e-commerce website, if they don't have reviews, they probably are struggling with their sales. To the, you're going to pick a restaurant in a town you haven't been in. You're going to pick a hotel to go to, on vacation. You're looking at the reviews, you're looking at the star ratings, and now what we're seeing is a huge proliferation of reviews and feedback making their way into the B2B world, to the point where there's a company here called TrustRadius that just did a study that now showed that B2B buyers are almost 2-to-1 looking at reviews from peers over analyst rankings and ratings. So, whereas marketers, we used to spend so much time worrying about what the analysts are saying about us, those are playing much less of a role in the way that buyers make decisions versus looking at reviews now. And it's changing the way that we sell, and it should change the way that we market.
Interesting. So let's go back in time just a bit so the younger listeners can understand some context here. Yep. You write that prior to the digital age we're all living in, and for those younger listeners, it wasn't always a digital age we were in. Yep. Salespeople used to have the power, and buyers needed sellers. Explain.
Well, yeah. I mean, how were you going to get information as a buyer when there was no internet? It was really hard to connect with your peers at other companies. You didn't have the societies and groups and all of that. You maybe had a conference you went to once a year. Mm-hmm. If you had a complaint, what were you going to do? I remember a time where, even growing up, where my dad would get mad about something and he would pull out a piece of paper or a typewriter and write a letter. To the business. And what are they going to do with it? So there was a time there where if you were trying to make a buying decision, and just consider this from a brain science perspective, is this hasn't changed ever, is that when we're looking to make a medium to high consideration purchase, meaning something that is going to matter, our brains are wired to seek out a prediction of what their experience is going to be like, right? Mm-hmm. So, I want to know that when I make this purchase, am I going to feel something from it from a status perspective? How certain am I of the experience I'm going to have? Am I going to maintain my autonomy? Like, all of those types of things. And how are you going to do that? That you, for the most part, have to call the company and look at some brochures maybe and talk to the salesperson. So it was very easy for them to hide flaws and hope to get away with it, because on the back end, the product didn't do what you said it was going to do. What is the buyer to do?
Right. And so when my dad was looking to buy a new car, first place he went to was the dealership.
Yes.
Couldn't really get very far without going to the dealership. Fast forward to a couple years ago when my wife wanted to buy a new car. Todd, where do you think the last place was she went to get information?
Oh, exactly. Exactly. And it's funny. I'm in the process right now. I literally on Monday was driving down the street and a piece of my car fell off. So I'm definitely in the market.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm almost nervous about it. Like, I'm a so-called sales expert, but I'm not a car buying expert. But I do know that the last thing I want to do is go sit in a dealership and be sold to.
Right, right. And I have a, an 18-year-old car, I think. It just keeps going. But deep down inside, I don't want to have to go through the process of buying another one.
Yes.
And
yeah, and it's funny, all of the advice that I'm getting from people. So I put a post on LinkedIn about it, and almost every suggestion is, hey, you know, go through the website, put in the contact us form that you're looking for this model and ask for an out the door price, right, and then take the best one and walk into the dealer with it and say, thank you. And that, it's trying to take the car sales people out of the equation, and that's not sustainable.
True. And when I bought my car in 2003, I was actually using email, but that's exactly what I did. I said, look, I want this car. Sent it to three different dealerships nearby, and I never showed up until I got exactly what you were looking for. So I may have been a little bit ahead of the curve, but I so dreaded that experience. Now, Todd, you didn't exactly answer the question. I said, where was the last place my wife went to get her information before buying a car? And what you implied was that she went to the dealership last.
Yeah.
That's actually not true. The last place she went was to her husband. She texted me from the dealership to ask me a question about what's a good monthly payment. So that's how I found out. But that's just me. That's just me. So
yep.
Let me add one other thing though, Todd, and this is what grinds my gears. There are way too many companies that think that their customers are buying the way my dad did when he was buying a car. They think, well, they're just going to come to us when they have a question. That we don't need to do that. What's your response to that?
Well, over the last, I guess it's, when you think about just the dawn of the information age in the 1970s, I believe what happened when you look at the popularity of sales books is there is a pocket of sales books that are incredibly popular from the early 1980s. And they were around this concept of strategic selling and conceptual selling. And what that indicates to me is that I believe we got through the 1970s and sellers suddenly woke up and realized that they were not adding value the way they used to, and they need to grasp onto something else. Now, fast forward 20 years to the digital age, and the same thing happened. And all of a sudden, when you look at the most popular and highest ranked sales books, they're all in that pocket of 2007 to 2016. And I believe the same thing happened. Salespeople were no longer adding value the way that they used to. And books like The Challenger Sale really changed the whole game and had people rethinking the way that they sell. What I believe, and I'm biased, but I also see the data that shows that now with this proliferation of reviews and feedback, that sellers are going to have to change again. I know that there's so much talk about AI, artificial intelligence and account-based marketing and sales, changing sales. I think we're still a few years behind where AI is really going to change the way buyers buy. But I believe today that reviews and feedback have to change the way sellers sell, and that's happening right now.
Oh, great. Just when I figure out a new way, now you're telling me we've got to change again. Hey, welcome to the future, folks. That's wish I could sugarcoat it for you.
Exactly.
So, Todd, let's talk briefly about the brain. Can you walk us through the three primary parts of the brain? Because this is going to be important for our discussion. We're talking about the reptilian brain, the limbic or the midbrain, and then the neocortex.
Yeah, I mean, so I'm clearly not a neuroscientist. When I started to learn about this stuff, I actually engaged a neuroscientist from DePaul University here in Chicago just to help vet out my nonsense. And then I tried to take it down to a level that salespeople and marketers would really understand. You know, the core to it is that we as human beings make decisions in that feeling and emotion center, which is what you refer to as the midbrain or the limbic, which is right in the middle. Mm-hmm. And all of our decisions start there. And then the neocortex, which wraps around it, is the logic center, which is used to justify the feeling and emotion decision that we just made. And then the reptilian brain essentially is, you know, your, ooh, that's hot, you know, like the instant part of the brain that, you know, makes very quick decisions based on stimuli and not based consciously. And so the reason I say that is, you know, there was two things that happened that really got the book going for me. And number one was that stat that you mentioned at the beginning, which is the 4.2 to 4.5 sells better than a 5. And I looked across my sales organization and realized that we had been teaching our salespeople to sell as though we were perfect. Mm-hmm. And essentially, we were pushing people away by that. And then as I dug a level deeper and started to look at the neuroscience as to why, I also realized that we were teaching salespeople to lead with logic.
Yes.
So ROI and data and features and benefits. But were we really keying on the things that help drive a decision and make it happen faster, which is the feelings and emotions that drive decision-making at its core? And so that's where that understanding of the brain is so important, because it drives everything, you know, not just the way you sell, but the way you market, the way you lead, the way you recruit, the way that you pitch an investor. I mean, it goes on and on. And so many of us are doing it wrong. And now, because we understand so much more about how the brain makes decisions, it's time to use that for good, not evil. And that's, you know, that's that core understanding.
Yes. And there was another book on the podcast called The Persuasion Code. And they talked about the reptilian brain. And I don't know, you don't advocate this, but after reading that book and then getting it reinforced with yours and a few others, it's almost as if the more I can think about prospective customers as being cavemen, even just briefly, it helps to reinforce that, yes, you know, that is actually very powerful. And if you don't get past that reptilian brain, the caveman brain, I don't know that you're really going to get to the logic part. You got to get through the emotion before you can get to the neocortex, the newest part of our brains. But let's go on. Could you talk about some of the fundamental truths of how the brain makes decisions in a sales context?
Yeah. I mean, I think that when you talked about the reptilian brain, you know, the first thing that I think we all need to realize is that we will always be perceived as sellers. And we will always be perceived in a way that even when you walk into a room getting ready to make a presentation, you could be super nice, but that buyer is waiting for the influence to come. They're on, you know, they're in kind of protect mode. Mm-hmm. And there's certain things that we're going to need to do to disarm that. So I think that reptilian brain still plays a very important role in the, you know, all the techniques are going to fall flat if we don't at least understand that. And it goes back to the car sales example. You know, there could be a car salesperson at my local dealership that is super nice and authentic and honest and is going to be transparent with me, but they may never get the chance because right now I'm in protect mode. So, you know, to answer your question, though, those fundamental truths, you know, really feed from that idea that we as human beings make decisions with emotions and feelings and back it up with logic. And that second piece that you mentioned when you read the piece of the book is that idea that as sellers and as marketers, we're trying to drive the decision maker to make one decision, which is to buy from us, when essentially they are making thousands of micro decisions with every time they see your name, your company name, your emails, your calls, your voicemails, your presentation slides. It plays a role in every single touch a buyer has with you. And we've got to know that and understand it. When we think about the most, you know, the highest percentage of losses that I bet any of your listeners have in the deals that they work are probably to the status quo.
Yes.
And in many cases, they never hear why, and they never hear that it's actually happened. And the last thing on that is a lot of times the buyers will give them logic-based answers as to why they're not moving forward. And it's our role to figure out what that feeling and emotion is that drove them to make that logical explanation to us.
Yes, you had a great story in the book about how you all were going to lose a customer at one of the companies you had, and they were giving you a logical reason, but you persisted to find out, and it had to do with emotional reasons. They felt like they weren't as important to your company, and it was fascinating. But one of the great takeaways from the book is you just talk about how our brains are designed to resist influence. Think about how people feel when they make the mistake of picking up the phone and finding out it's a cold call.
Yeah.
You know, and you talk about ways, even in a sales situation, where you can disarm them somewhat with transparency and radical honesty. And one of the other things you talked about was one of these fundamental truths, and this is so relevant to marketers creating content. Our brains are wired to make decisions with emotion and feelings. And if you deny that, you're going to lose. What the author's talking about is that they then justify those decisions for themselves and to the outside world using logic. And just recently, I saw a quote from Dale Carnegie, of all people, basically saying the same thing. Now, in the book, you talk about the SCARF model.
Yes.
By Dr. David Rock, who is no relation to actor Dwayne Johnson, The Rock. You know, Todd, when you're the host of the Marketing Book Podcast, you have to research these things. But
that's right.
Okay, no relation. Although The Rock, Dwayne Johnson, now this is really important for the listener. His middle name is Douglas. My first name, Douglas. Coincidence? I don't know. Okay, so you talk about the SCARF model, and those,
yes.
It's an acronym for status, certainty, autonomy, relatedness, and fairness.
Yes.
And you talk about the importance of making sure that whatever you're doing from a sales and marketing standpoint, you're doing what you can to address those things. Could you just walk us through briefly examples of status, certainty, autonomy, relatedness, and fairness?
Yeah, I mean, that's the question. When I talk about feelings and emotions, people automatically say, oh gosh, I got to get him to cry. I got to, you know, no, that's not the kind of feelings and emotions
we're
talking
about.
Well, your
book did make me cry, Todd, but go ahead.
Oh, well, thank you.
I laughed. I cried. We'll get to the laugh part later.
And, you know, that SCARF model are the things that we need to think about. As a sales leader, when I first discovered the SCARF model, I actually wrote it up on my whiteboard, and it was always next to me for every customer call. But, you know, I think to this whole point, when you asked for an example, I think it's part of the reason why reviews and feedback are overtaking in trust from a buyer, all things that marketers are doing. You know, in terms of this, that trust radius study that I talked about, where buyers were asked what pieces of marketing and things that they use during the buying cycle they most and least trust. On the most side was reviews. On the least trust was on the least side were the website, brochures, and case studies. Now,
like advertising's probably further down there too.
Yeah, exactly. It's things like that that I think are kind of rocking our world. And so, to get to your question, think about that the C in SCARF, which is certainty. Again, as buyers, we're trying to predict what our experience is going to be like. And that's why having both positive and negative reviews right next to products. So think about anything that you're going to buy, having both positive and negative reviews right next to the product, it works pretty darn well for websites, right? It's when the e-commerce site is acting as the seller that works. So why wouldn't that work when in a face-to-face selling environment? And again, that's the buyer. One of the things that's really important to them in their feeling and emotion decision-making is certainty. And they need to be able to paint a picture for themselves of what not only the pros are, but what the cons are going to be too. And if they don't get that from you, the seller, they're going to go find it. And today
they're going to get it whether or not you tell them.
Exactly. And that when they get something different, when they do their own homework than what they got from you, well, let's see. Sales cycles lengthen, win rates go down. You know, we make it a lot easier on our competitors to bombard the trust that we've built with our buyers. So that certainty piece is super important. You know, the other ones, I mean, when you think about status, for example, just a quick story there that I talk about in the book is, you know, one of my neighbors driving up in a new Corvette. And I asked him, like what led you to this? Like, wow.
It was the gas mileage, right?
Well, yeah, his answer was acceleration that he was having trouble accelerating onto the expressway with his old car, and he wanted something with a little pick me up. And then it so happened that the Chevy dealer that he bought the Corvette from had a great APR, like finance rate. And he was like, those two things together, it was perfect.
And it didn't have anything to do with the midlife crisis he's dealing with?
Well, yeah, there was a feeling of status, right? And that regaining his youth, you know, middle 40s guy. I don't blame him.
Sure. I'm not judging here.
Exactly. But it speaks to, as sellers, we hear the logic and, you know, we go talk to our managers and go talk to the marketing department and say, hey, the real reason this guy bought is for the acceleration and that great finance rate. But we all know that's not true. And that's the same thing that's happening in our selling world. When we hear logic, there's feeling behind it. And it's typically one of those five things that we have to go pick for.
Oh, that's great. One of the other eternal truths, and you already mentioned it, is that human beings make over 90% of their decisions subconsciously. And it brings to mind something that always made me laugh inside. Sitting on the other side of a two-way mirror, watching focus groups and hearing consumers, whatever the product category was the moderator was talking about, saying things like, I'm not influenced by advertising. I'm not influenced by what other people tell me. And they just didn't know what they didn't know.
Yeah.
But you mentioned homework. Can you explain what you mean when you say the higher the trust, the less homework for the buyer?
Yeah. And there was actually, since the book came out, there's a study by Gartner that talked about the fact that in a typical buying cycle, you know, what are the things that buyers do? And as it turns out, only 39% of the things buyers do are either talking to you and your competitors or talking to their internal teams. The other 61% is them doing homework, which means they're doing research. They are looking at analyst reports. They're doing reference checks. They're back channeling you. But, you know, in today's world, they're looking at reviews. On, you know, here in the United States, there's a lot of sites that are popping up in the technology space, like G2 Crowd and Trust Radius.
Yeah.
There's in the recruiting world, like many of you are probably hiring, there's a company called Glassdoor that has over $1 billion valuation that's collecting, displaying reviews from current and former employees that give you insight into not only if I'm a recruit, I want to know what the culture is that I'm getting into, but I'm starting to see buyers do that, where they're looking at that to understand, all right, what are the people like that I'm going to be dealing with? So here's the thing about your question is, when I walk into a selling environment and I lead with our flaws and lead with transparency and essentially present what they will likely find when they go do their research, that when they go do their research and they find that it matches, their need to go do more homework goes down because you've established trust. And that 61% goes down dramatically. And there was one case study that I talk about in the book where in what normally would have been a 6-week sale or a 6-month sales cycle, we closed in somewhere between 4 and 6 weeks. We dropped it dramatically by leading with flaws and transparency because they trusted us. Because the minute they walked out and called a peer and looked at a review site and they saw it matched, they didn't need to do much more.
Yes, it's interesting. And it also, pardon me, but I read all these books, so I can't resist mentioning another one. There was another book on the podcast a couple years ago by Marcus Sheridan called They Ask You Answer. And he was a guy who had a fiberglass pool company in Virginia in 2008, hit with the big real estate crash, and nobody was buying pools at that point. They ran out of money. And what he did, because he didn't want to declare bankruptcy as their financial advisors recommended, he just started answering with radical transparency every question he ever got from a customer. Like, when should I not buy a fiberglass pool? When is concrete better than fiberglass? What does a pool cost? They vowed to answer. And even they even included, one day a prospect said, we like you, Marcus. We'll probably buy from you. But if we didn't buy from you, who are the other pool companies here in town? He then went and wrote an article about the pool companies in Richmond, Virginia. Now it's number one on Google for pool companies in Richmond. But it was, what happened was they then realized that this was really working. Yeah. And they would get a call from a prospect and say, hey, we'd like you to come out and talk to us about getting a pool. Well, you know, and they would check to make sure they were in their service area. And then what they did is they would say, okay, great. here, let's set the appointment. Now, we're going to send you a little ebook about everything you need to know about buying a fiberglass pool, pros and cons, all that sort of thing. And we also have a little video we made. It kind of explains the process. You know, you have to get permits. You have to dig a hole. There's lots of things that have to happen. We're going to call you back the day before the appointment. And if you haven't had a chance to read the little ebook and watch the video, no problem. We'll just reschedule. And in the course of their business, maybe only four said no, and they knew they were bad prospects, but they were closing at like 80 to 85% on those visits because they had been so radically transparent. So I just thought that might help to warm the cockles of your heart and let the listener know that this is a thing.
Yeah. If you could see me right now, there's a tear rolling down my cheek. It's beautiful.
Well, I'll have to introduce you to Marcus. So let's go. I want to talk about sales. And again, I'm sorry, but I just got a quote from the book. This is at the beginning of chapter four, which is why change, why you, why now? In order to apply transparency to selling effectively, we must answer the following question. What does a salesperson really do? What are they actually responsible for? Ultimately, the success or failure of a company is in its ability to effectively sell its product and services. A sale is an outcome. If your product is weak, but salespeople are still able to sell those products, your company will stay in business, at least in the short term. If the economy is struggling and customer budgets are tight, but salespeople are able to find ways to motivate customers to spend on your products, your company will stay in business. If your management team is weak, but your sales team is strong and able to sell your products and services into the market, despite the company's poor leadership, your company will stay in business. For better or worse, a company's success is determined greatly by how it sells. But then you go on to say, however, the digital age has made selling a buyer's market, like we talked about earlier, where a buyer has the upper hand in establishing their feelings around a potential purchase before they ever talk to you. A sales activity focused checklist must now be grounded in the fact that our potential buyers are at a different stage in determining how your product or service could fit into their lives. We must rethink the traditional sales process and consider each activity with the buyer in mind. Todd Capone, what are you talking about?
Well, yeah, I mean, if you think about the different states that you're in when a buyer or when a seller calls you, you know, you're in one of three, right? Like number one is you're actively buying. So the person calls you or reaches out to you and you're like, wow.
And that's probably a smaller percentage of buyers, right?
A very small percentage, right? And so we can't always be just looking for those. But we need to sell differently to those people that are actively buying versus the next group, which is a little bit bigger, which are passive buyers, meaning they understand that what they're doing today probably could be better. And I think there's a quote I talk about. It's a phrase that's somebody used in a book called couch tracking, which is, you know, you're keeping an eye on things, but you're not ready to actively buy. So if you're a seller, you've got to sell a little bit differently to those people. Then the third category, which are those status quo people that are happy with what they're doing today, no matter how bad it might be. You know, they're still washing their clothes on rocks and you're selling a washing machine, right? Right. And so when you think about it, you've got to sell differently to those people too. So it's important to recognize where our buyers are. And that goes into the point around sales process that so many traditional sales processes are based on what the seller is doing. Like, have I had a first meeting? Have I sent a proposal? Right. I presented. Well, it doesn't matter. We've got to get really good at recognizing where the buyer is. Which one of those states are they in? Are they engaged? Are they making a decision? Have they decided? It's all about making this about where the buyer is. And to the first part of that quote, have they decided that their status quo is no longer sustainable? So that's why change. And then once they have, they need to decide whether or not you are the right company to do business with. And once they've decided that, the really hard one often is, why do I have to do this now? And yes, that's your sales process. And it's all based on where the buyer is.
Right. Now, the status quo group is probably the biggest, right?
Yes.
Why do you argue that that is the best opportunity?
Well, those are the ones that are typically, if you do those right, where you establish trust, and it goes back to the book, The Challenger Sale, mm-hmm, where there's an element of education that needs to take place there too. But those are the ones where you really build the relationships with your customer, where if they're able to come on board and understand because of the way that you've approached things, that their status quo is no longer sustainable, they're yours.
Yes.
And those are typically the most valuable opportunities, not only short term, but in terms of long term customer value.
And it brings to mind the concept we just talked about of they don't feel like they have to do as much homework because they've helped you understand what your why the pain of same is worse than the pain of change, to yes. quote from the Challenger customer.
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
So in chapter 5, you go into really helpful detail about using email as part of your outreach program, and we won't go into all the details of that, but explain for the listener the concept that undergirds all of that about always be giving without expectation. I just still don't see much of that when I'm being sold to.
Exactly. Well, there's two things in this chapter. I wanted to take a step back and talk about the other subconscious thing that I want everybody who's listening to this to realize. And it's this idea that historically in marketing, we've always focused so much on optimizing for the subject line because it's the subject line that gets the open, you know, and so you've got to be really tricky with it.
Right.
Well, not today. I can't think of an inbox that I have where you can't see a preview of the first 10 words of an email. You've got to optimize for those two. And when I looked at my email inbox as a CRO, and you know, I've got a snapshot in the book of mine.
So it's hilarious. So glad you included that visual.
Yeah, and it all starts with I wanted to know this. We wanted to know this. We think this. And then there's the great part, which is the guilt trips, which is, Todd, why haven't you responded to me? Oh, I wanted to make sure you got this. I've sent you 3 emails so far. Those are the types of those guilt trip ones crack me up because it's like, well, thanks for the reminder as to why I didn't open the last ones. Right. So I think the point
I'm laughing there, to keep from crying, Todd.
Exactly. And so to your question around always be giving, what are the emails that are going to stand out? It's the ones that when I look at my inbox, I'm subconsciously thinking, is this email here to sell me or to help me? And the ones that are here to sell me, I'm sorry, but as a CRO getting 100 emails a day, I don't have time for those unless I'm actively buying and something really hits me. But again, that's a very tiny percentage. The ones that stand out are the ones where somebody is giving me something and not expecting to get. Now, I know subconsciously they are eventually expecting to get, but you know, there was one company that was sending me, you know, in one email, they sent me a study for what people in sales development roles were making in the Chicago area, recognizing that I had 3 of those roles open on my website. And so it was a salary survey they sent me and they just said, hey, Todd, here's a salary survey for SDRs in Chicago. Thought it might be helpful to you. There was nothing else. And I looked at it and I was like, wow, this is really helpful. A week later, they sent me it was right after the end of a quarter. They sent me a template for a board meeting deck. And they just said, hey, a bunch of CROs in tech are using this kind of flow. I thought it might be useful to you. After I read that one, I looked at the template and it was great. Like I actually used pieces of it. I was like, wait a second, who are these guys? And so I went into the email signature. I clicked around. I found out who they were. And we ended up eventually, I don't think we bought from them, but it was establishing this relationship that these people are really understanding who I am in a personalized way and focused on providing value to me in that personalized way. And I think that's got to be the future of email prospecting, at least, is less about me, I'm here to sell you, and more about, hey, listen, let's build a relationship first. I want to help you out. And then when you're ready, I'm here to talk.
Right. Always be giving without expectation. It's almost like they need to dub that into Glengarry Glen Ross when Alec Baldwin is saying, always be closing.
Yep.
So anyway, just in case Hollywood hears that. So before we move on, just a couple of things I want to ask you about. Can you just remind folks about why embracing vulnerability actually gives you power?
Well, yeah, it goes to that whole concept of the 4.2 to 4.5. And there's one, I'm going to quote a famous supermodel here. I don't talk about it in the book, but Tyra Banks.
This is extra, folks. This is extra. You know, you're only on the Marketing Book Podcast. Please go ahead.
Yes.
Particularly as it relates to supermodels.
And I want everybody to write down this word. It is the word flossom. It's a Tyra Banksism, but she talks about this idea of you know, she wrote a book called Perfect is Boring, and she's really built a whole business around it. But it's this idea to know that we're all imperfect. Every company is imperfect. And when we embrace our flaws, but know that we're still great, that, you know, that is what really engages people. And so the point there is embrace your vulnerability, but to a point. We don't want people going out and telling the world, hey, this is why we suck. But again, it's this idea of embracing your flaws, understanding what buyers are going to find when they go do their research anyway, and leading with it. And again, it not only disarms, so that's the brain science part, but the data shows us that that imperfection wins, and that we actually have a higher win rate, a faster sales cycle. We qualify deals in faster when we lead with our vulnerabilities, and we, more importantly, qualify deals out faster that we probably would lose eventually anyway. Yes. When we lead with those vulnerabilities too. I mean, the old axiom is if you're going to lose, it's better to lose fast. And that's a great way to do it. So that's that whole concept of when we lead with transparency and our vulnerabilities, we're doing wonders for the buying brain, but we're also doing wonders for our wallet in terms of results.
Yes. So it also brings to mind one of my favorite sales expressions, which is no is my second favorite word. If I can find that out more quickly, we're all better off. And there was a book on the podcast from a fellow Chicago resident, Dr. Philip Kotler at Northwestern University, the 100th episode of this show, it called Marketing 4.0. And in the book, one of the things that really struck me was he talked about how in this digital age, the companies that are more seemingly vulnerable are actually going to do better because it, in part, helps to answer the subconscious question of what's the catch?
Yeah, I think the one story I tell that really gets people's attention there, I mean, if you think about Southwest Airlines, who really embraced the idea that they're not going to be giving meals and nice drinks on planes, you're going to get a bag of nuts. And, you know, Progressive Insurance with, hey, we're going to show you the prices of our policies, but also the ones of our competitors. But the one that always jumps out is IKEA, and that we all know that we're not going to have much sales help on the floor when we're trying to pick out furniture there. We know that we're going to have to pack the thing onto a cart without brakes in the warehouse ourselves, and then jam it into a car in the parking lot that we'll probably end up injuring ourselves once or twice. We'll get it home, and then the fun really begins when we open the box to hundreds of parts and no words in the instructions. Yet we know that we are probably going to go back because we have gotten this modern Scandinavian design furniture that looks pretty good and you didn't pay a whole lot for. IKEA doesn't hide any of that. That's their brand, right? And I think when we think about that as selling organizations, there are things that we're going to say, hey, we're not going to be as good at these things so that we can be excellent at these. And if we're, as marketers, not only curating all of the feedback that we see across the web about our organizations, but inherently understanding what those flaws are about our organization, and then arming the sales organization with those messages as to why you're a 4.2 to a 4.5, the results are stunning. Like when I started trying it at Power Reviews, it was magic. And that's really what led me to go, all right, I think there's a book here.
Yes. And the book doesn't have just sales and marketing things. It also has other really practical things. And I just want to ask like three other things before we start to wrap up. One of them has to do with presentations. One has to do with job interviews. And the last one has to do with trade shows. So explain for the listener what can be learned from reality TV shows that can improve presentations dramatically.
This is a discovery I made a few years ago where I realized I'm not a huge reality makeover TV show guy, but I realized that they were all using the exact same choreography. And when you see choreographies that work in sales, I suddenly recognized this match, and it changed reality makeover TV shows for me forever. But let's take a step back here. So most sales presentations that I see when I'm asked to coach companies on that are all we at the beginning, right? It's, hey, here's our mission, here's our products, here's our locations, here's our awards we've won, and then here's our NASCAR slide filled with logos like a NASCAR of all the companies we do business with.
Right.
Now, in reality makeover TV shows, they flip that script, and it's never about the presenters or the people that are actually executing on the show. It's all about the participants. Now, the participants recognized they have a problem. They raised their hand and said, I want this makeover, whether it's Restaurant Impossible doing kitchen makeovers or The Biggest Loser doing health makeovers or even Queer Eye on Netflix now, which is just overall life makeovers. Those people recognize they have a problem. They've invited you in, very similar to a sales situation. And the people that are actually executing on the show, so the I guess in Restaurant Impossible, it's Robert Irvine, who's a chef going into a restaurant. He's understanding what their current status quo is. And then he's very quickly showing them that, hey, that status quo is actually worse than you thought. And you knew it wasn't great already by identifying a couple of things that maybe Robert, as an expert, knows that that individual does not. They match it up with emotion because that's how we make decisions and back it up with some logic. And then they talk about what the future is going to look like and they go on a path together. Now, reality makeover TV shows, they tell a great story, but the other thing that they do that's magic is they compel that participant to run through a brick wall for these people in every single episode. And that's what you want to do as a seller. So imagine a reality makeover TV show where the beginning of every single episode is the host of the show talking about how great they are for the first 15 right. minutes. Like, you would turn the show off. And if we think about that in a selling capacity where we always start with their current state, we then go to showing them why that current state is actually worse than they thought and no longer sustainable, and then end with the future state, which is what you and your organization do, and you just reorder your slides. The engagement you're going to get, because again, our reptilian brain is not wanting to listen for very long. And if you're going to start by talking about them and how their status quo could be better, that's how you get the engagement and how you get people that want to come along with you on the ride.
Yes. And Todd, I can't resist. I just have to quote from one part where you talked about an episode of Queer Eye for the Straight Guy. And it was this episode that features a 58-year-old man named Tom Jackson. Tom lives in a rundown apartment in the basement of a home featuring an old stained recliner chair. He refers to his favorite time of day being when he can sit outside on his porch, have a cigarette, a redneck margarita, which was simply a Mountain Dew mixed with tequila. I learned so much in your book, Todd, and watch TV on the porch. He has been divorced 3 times and is clearly a disheveled, unhappy mess. Well, of course, I'm reading about this guy sitting on his porch watching television, drinking a redneck margarita, and I'm thinking, Todd, you say that like it's a bad thing. This sounds like many of my close friends. But then you go on to explain that the crew that shows up help him to understand why those are a bad thing. In other words, that was his status quo, and then they helped him understand why making changes would actually improve his life, which they go on to do. So it was very interesting. I'd never seen it, and I love the expression, the NASCAR slide. I've never seen that before, but I see it all the time. I see it on websites. It's look at all the logos. Look at all the companies we've worked for, which helps probably with some of the persuasion. Let's talk now about job interviews. So there's the classic situation of somebody being in a job interview, and I don't know that I was ever asked this in a job interview, but it's like, well, what are some of your weaknesses? And so you even joke in here about some of the worst possible responses. So I want the listeners to understand what I'm about to read. Don't do this if you're ever asked this in an interview. So they say, well, tell us, you know, what would you say are some of your weaknesses? And of course, this is usually asked after they say, well, what are some of your strengths? So one answer, again, don't do this, is, well, I've been told I just work too darn hard. I get so passionate about my work that I put my heart and soul into it. People have told me that I should get a hobby, but work has always been my hobby. Or another one is, I'm self-critical in that I demand top performance in myself. Everything I deliver, whether it be internally or externally, is a reflection of me, and therefore I make sure that it's a representation of my work ethic and drive. I almost wanted to hear the word hustle in there, but you spared us. Thank you. And the last one was, which I thought was brilliant, and maybe if you've been drinking a redneck margarita before the interview, which again, Mountain Dew with tequila, is this one is, I had a weakness, but I fixed it. Now my weakness is that I don't have any weakness. So If somebody ever gets that question, or more importantly, you don't get asked that, what's the best way to bring that up in a job interview that could actually be helpful and disarming?
Well, I always call it the elephant in the room, but when I've been interviewing people before, I do my homework before it, and I think most interviewees do, where I know what I'm looking for in the role, and I've read your resume before you walk in, and there's typically things that will jump out to me as, hey, here's where there isn't a match. So as an interviewee, I would hope that I would have the empathy to understand what those things might be, and typically, you know, I would. And I would try to lead with those. So for example, let's say the job requirement says that you have to have 7 years of specific experience and an MBA. And let's say you only have 5 years of experience and you don't have an MBA. So are you going to just hide that until the end and hope they don't ask? If they ask, what are your weaknesses? You're going to make up one of those other ones. I'm a believer in leading with that elephant in the room at the beginning, and even almost start with the, hey, listen, I understand that the requirements for this role are an MBA and 7 years of experience. You've probably seen from my resume that I don't possess either one. Can we start there? Like, let's talk a little bit about that, because I want to make sure you're comfortable with that before we really dig in. Now, as an interviewer, I would burst into tears. Like, that would be incredible. And so as an interviewee, I mean, talk about building trust, leading with that. I just think it's magic. And I don't know if I've ever had anybody that's done that. But I believe that if you're really going to embrace this and know that an interview is a classic example of sales, regardless of what role you're in, that embracing your vulnerabilities and your imperfections as it relates to what the buyer, who's the interviewer, might be looking for, is an incredible way to speed your sales cycle, which is to get that job.
Yes. And even 20-something years ago, I had a client with a company that was later acquired, and it was president of the company, Metro Information Services, and it was Andy Downing. And I remember meeting him once, and he said that it was an IT firm. When they would go into a company and the subject of references came up, he would say, you know, we're like anybody, we can give you a list of companies that have been happy with us, but we're going to give you a list of references where we had a problem and we worked through it together.
Yes.
Holy cow. Amazing.
That's part of this whole concept of, you know, so many organizations worry because they overuse their references, which happen to be only the customers that have had a perfect experience.
Yeah.
And I think that you've got a much broader reference base when you think about it that way. Mm-hmm. That let's think about the companies that haven't always been great, but are still with us. Let's figure out why, and they would probably be even better references for us than the ones that have had nothing but perfect, because again, our buying brain is trying to assess both the pros and cons in their effort to forecast what their experience is going to be like.
Okay, so last thing, trade shows. Boy, you know, I might go to a trade show, but the last thing I want to do is talk to somebody in a booth, because they're trying to sell to me. Talk about how companies can make their booths a magnet for their target customers at conferences if everyone is so resistant to being sold to. And you had a specific example from a company that I just thought was brilliant.
Yeah. This came from, I was talking to the CEO of a company about this after I went to a conference where basically there was very little attendance. So we spent a bunch of money on a booth. I had salespeople there, and there was 100 booths, right? And I saw people, potential buyers walking the floor, and they were getting attacked. It was like, you know, meat in a shark tank. And as I talked to the CEO about it, he was like, hey, you know, one thing that we did, which was amazing, is that we had customers who were attending the event. We helped subsidize their conference attendance by spending time in the booth with us. And instead of us having sellers in the booth, what we did is we put shirts saying, I don't even work here, I'm a customer, or something to that effect. And the booth was a magnet. I mean, there was a countless number of potential prospects that were coming to the booth knowing that it was basically a no-sale zone. And isn't that what you want? So I think there's other ways you can do it. You know, you don't have to go as far as having, you know, paying your customers to be in the booth, but put your product people in the booth, put client success people in the booth. And it's not to say that salespeople shouldn't be at conferences, because it's a great opportunity to maximize your time value. But I think your booth itself needs to be a no sales zone if you really want to attract people.
Yes. And you can even put up a sign that says no sales zone. And there was another book on the podcast talking about why salespeople are very often not the people you want in your booth.
Yes.
They should definitely be there. So, Todd, you know, we won't have time to go into this, but there was just one other thing in your book where you talked about there was a study that showed that more than $30 billion is spent by inebriated Americans in 2017. And then you go on to say that men spent more than twice the amount than women did while drunk in that period. And I'm just wondering, do you have any advice on how I can target those companies? Because that would really help me my sales if I could, you know, target drunk people. No, I don't want you to answer that. I just remember that at one point, in lieu of a midlife crisis, I started doing stand-up comedy, and the only thing I learned, I'm all better now. Thanks, I don't do it anymore. But the only thing I learned is that the drunker the audience, the funnier I was. So anyway, after we were finished recording, you could just tell me how to find those people that are buying while they're really inebriated. I think that would probably up my sales. So
exactly. And the point there was, I mean, there was a time where that was the way you sold. You got people to ball games and golf courses and casinos and even worse places, and you got them drunk, and that's how you got them to buy. And most organizations have recognized that, because that connection between you know, your liver and the midbrain, that feeling brain, there's an enhancement that goes on there that really drives people to have heightened feelings, and they're more likely to make decisions when they're drunk. So I thought it was super interesting, and it was really a testament to how organizations are trying to put as much logic back into decision-making, not only by eliminating all of that, but by really getting firm around their RFP processes and not accepting any gifts, a number of things like that.
Yes, and there have been high-profile firings by companies where they found out that an employee actually went to a party from a potential vendor. I think Walmart, that even came up a few years back where they'd hired an agency, and they found out the employee had gone to a party that agency had. They fired that agency. They hired another one. So,
yeah.
Todd, if readers took only one thing away from the book, what would you hope it would be?
As we talked about from the beginning, it is transparency sells better than perfection. And it's that idea that, hey, when a website is acting as the salesperson, a 4.2 to a 4.5 sells better than a 5. And when you are acting as a salesperson, perfection is actually pushing people away. So it's definitely that transparency and imperfection sells better than perfection.
Right. What books have inspired your work and career? And I should say, in fairness, because we've really gone long in this interview, but doggone it, I've been having too much fun. At the end of your book, you mention 20 books on page 183. And what we're going to do is, in your show notes at marketingbookpodcast.com, we're going to have links to every single one of them so people can check them out. But
oh, great.
What books have most inspired your work and career?
Well, I've always been a nerd for this stuff. So I've always been somebody who knew that I wasn't that smart, so I better get smart. And so books have always been a real foundation for how to just stay ahead of everybody else. Sales is a highly competitive business. And, you know, there's some other, I mean, so there's obviously the classic sales books, but there was a couple that really jumped out. Like, I remember in the early 2000s, Brian Tracy came out with Goals, and, you know, just about the psychology around just writing down your goals and the correlation that has to your ability to actually hit them. And I started doing that a long time ago, and it's made a difference. Like, that's a big one. But then in the last year or two, just around the book, I mean, there was ones like Persuasion by Robert Cialdini, you know, around the kind of the neuroscience of influence that really got the wheels turning. And then so many others that you're going to list out just from the research that I learned so much, and I had so much fun digging into.
Oh, that's great. And one of my career highlights has been interviewing Dr. Cialdini about his book, Persuasion. I almost thought, you know, I think I can almost stop the podcast now. I've interviewed Dr. Kotler, Dr. Cialdini. That's it. Mic drop. I'm out of here. But anyway, yeah. So are there any recent or upcoming books that you recommend or are looking forward to reading now that you've had time to go back to reading more books?
Well, yeah, I always have a pile here. There's so many that get recommended. And then I typically, in the first couple of chapters, all of a sudden I'm like, this one's awesome. Where's my highlighter? I just read one as I'm trying to, I've been starting to look in the neuroscience around cultures and getting top performance out of salespeople. And I just read the book by Don Rehm, and I think it's maybe a 2017 book, but it's called Thrive by Design.
Oh.
And it's fascinating around the neuroscience that drives high performance cultures. And there's just so many interesting things that I experienced as a multiple time sales leader that now I know what buttons to hit, which ones don't, in a time where the demand for high experience talent is so much higher than the supply, that when you find people, you better keep them and you better create an environment where they want to help recruit others.
Uh-huh.
The other book is just came out, which is from a guy named Max Yoder. The book is called Do Better Work. And again, it's about that finding clarity, camaraderie, and progress around work and life and work-life balance. And it just, Max Yoder is a treasure, a CEO of a company called Lessonly in Indianapolis. And his book really embraces the kind of culture that he brings to that environment.
Oh, interesting. So how best can listeners learn more about you and your new book?
Well, they can follow me on LinkedIn. So it's just Todd Capone. I do publish a bunch of nonsense, weekly or a couple of times a week there. But in terms of the book or learning a little bit more about me and my speaking workshops and the training that I do, is you can go to transparencysale.com or toddcapone.com. Either one will take you to the same place.
Terrific. And we will include links to your site, your LinkedIn profile, your Twitter handle, and all the books that you've mentioned, as well as the other 20 that are at the end of the book, on this episode's show notes at marketingbookpodcast.com that I mentioned, so that listeners can find all that and also reach out to you and connect with you and thank you for being a guest. I've heard from authors on the podcast who talk about how much they appreciate hearing from listeners. And for you, dear listener, if you're listening on your smartphone and you've subscribed to the Marketing Book Podcast on iTunes or your favorite podcast app, all these links can be found by going to this episode on your podcast player and clicking on the show notes link. Also, at long last, I'd like to thank so many of you for leaving iTunes reviews. When you do a review, iTunes gives a podcast a lot more visibility. So if you've left an iTunes review, please connect with me on LinkedIn and send me a screenshot of the review so I can read it and your mailing address wherever you are in the world. And I will send you a thank you note, a Marketing Book Podcast bookmark, and a Marketing Book Podcast laptop sticker. Pretty cool, huh? So the name of the book is The Transparency Sale, How Unexpected Honesty and Understanding the Buying Brain Can Transform Your Results. The author is Todd Capone. Todd, thank you very much for joining us on the Marketing Book Podcast.
Thank you for having me. That was fun.
And that closes the book on episode 226 of the Marketing Book Podcast. For more, check out this episode's show notes at marketingbookpodcast.com. And if I can recommend a specific marketing or sales book or other helpful resource for whatever situation you find yourself in, feel free to connect with me on LinkedIn where we can chat and I'll try to point you in the right direction. My name again is Douglas Burdett. Special thanks to our sponsor, Blinkist. To support the Marketing Book Podcast and start your free Blinkist trial or get 20% off your yearly plan, visit Blinkist.com/marketingbookpodcast or just click on the link at marketingbookpodcast.com. And please join us next time as we welcome Scott McCain to the Marketing Book Podcast to talk about his book, Iconic, How Organizations and Leaders Attain, Sustain, and Regain the Highest Level of Distinction. Thanks again for listening to the Marketing Book Podcast. This episode was produced by Sean Armstrong. Todd, just one other thing, you know, aside from maybe being a kidney stone survivor, are there any other interesting facts that somebody might not have known, you know, about you? Like, you know, for instance, 4 of Illinois' last 7 governors went to prison. You met 2 of them or something like that.
Looks like you need a vacation. Enter the 5-Hour Energy Where Will the Tide Take You sweepstakes. You could win a $10,000 dream beach vacation. Imagine jet setting off to a tropical paradise. having fun in the sun, or diving at a gorgeous reef. It's up to you. No purchase necessary. Go to 5HETIDE.com for official rules and to enter. That's 5HETIDE.com. Enter today. Ends June 30th, 2024.